Hey there, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Tonight, as the state legislature seeks to wrap up the state budget, we talk with Charles Kahn of Strong Economy for All about the effort to raise taxes on the rich to avoid massive cuts in state spending. Then for our Peace Bucket, we talk with Linda Koshgarian of the National Priorities Project about the disparities between the federal government's spending on defense versus public health. After that, Water Vliet School Board member Amanda Kavanaugh talks to Corinne Carey about the Vliet Never Gives Up t-shirt initiative she launched to help support local restaurants and kids in need. And then ColorWorks Radio is back. We hear from artist Darian Longmire about how his work is being impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. And we'll finish out with Human Rights Campaign about the impact of COVID-19 on the LGBTQ community. But first, headlines. A Rensselaer County judge on Wednesday declared a mistrial in the quadruple murder trial of James White more than a week after jurors began deciding the fate of the Schenectady man charged with brutally stabbing two adults and two children in a Lansingburg home. Deliberations at White's trial were postponed this week after one of the jurors got sick and two were reluctant to come in due to COVID-19. The Times Union reports that the criminal trial surrounding the Stretch Ford excursion that was involved in the horrific limo crash in Schoharie, which killed 20 people in October of 2018. Naman Hussein, the owner of the limo company, is facing delays in the aftermath of the COVID-19 outbreak. The trial is scheduled to begin next month. General Electric Company's unions are calling for GE to start making ventilators in Schenectady and other sites across the country where GE has been laying off workers amid the COVID-19 outbreak. The union notes that while GE is a major supplier of ventilators already, it does so with the help of third-party manufacturers and suppliers. Following public backlash for some Saratoga County officials approving their own pay hikes for work during the COVID-19 pandemic, the county will no longer pay time and a half to its salaried administrators and other essential employees for every hour they work during the outbreak. Instead, the county has decreased the number of employees receiving overtime pay from more than 350 to an estimated 40 employees working in the county's COVID-19 command center. Albany Medical Center has begun accepting COVID-19 patients from the New York City area. Normally, about one out of every four patients at Albany Med are transfer patients from other hospitals. Governor Cuomo said earlier this week that hospital systems statewide are working out a plan for how to relieve hospitals who are at or near capacity due to a surge of COVID-19 patients. State legislative leaders are trying to pass a state budget that has slipped past the April 1st deadline, with the state anticipating a $15 billion drop in revenues. Cuts in many parts of the budget are expected, including education and healthcare, the two largest items. Lawmakers will delay several billion dollars in cuts from the governor's Medicaid redesign task force, which will enable the state to accept an extra $6 billion in federal funding for the program. The legislature did approve the governor's proposed ban on styrofoam and the speeding up of the siting of large-scale renewable energy projects, despite opposition to the latter from local governments. Marijuana legalization was dropped once again from the budget. Some limited changes were agreed to with respect to last year's reform on cash bail. Work will continue on Governor Cuomo's project to build 350 miles of new bike and hiking trails to create the Empire State Trail. The state had made an exception during the pandemic for park maintenance. The Small Business Development Center at SUNY Albany is hosting web conferences to help people learn how to apply for SBA loans through SBA lenders. Forgiveness of the loans is based on the employer maintaining or quickly rehiring employees and maintaining salary levels, reports the Times Union. A few hours after midnight, Governor Cuomo said he reached a, quote, conceptual agreement, unquote, on the state budget with leaders of both legislative chambers, per the Times Union. The budget package is likely to be much smaller than the $178 billion spending plan Cuomo initially proposed in January. Cuomo declined to provide specific details about the budget package. He told reporters they would have to, quote, wait and see for the status of individual policy items. On a final rule issued Tuesday, the Trump administration rolled back Obama-era efforts that attempted to increase auto gas mileage standards, create more fuel-efficient cars, and encourage development of electric vehicles. The Daily Gazette reports that Trump's new rules will allow for nearly 1 billion more tons of carbon dioxide to be released into the environment and prompt consumers to consume more than 80 billion gallons of gasoline. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or would like to write a letter to the editor, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Up first on our show tonight, Charles Kahn from New York's Strong for All campaign talks to Corinne Carey about the movement to increase the tax rate for ultra-rich New Yorkers to close the gaping budget hole during the COVID-19 pandemic.
By the time this piece airs, the New York state budget will have been more likely than not passed. I think it's fair to say that we're not only in a public health crisis, but we're also in a budget crisis. The budget was already in trouble before COVID-19 hit New York, and even more so now. One of the ways that advocates have looked at this is, if there was ever a time to levy higher taxes on the wealthy, it's now. What's going to happen?
I think there are two distinct paths in front of New York. I think that with the coronavirus, if the projections are correct, there are going to be many people that lose their lives, which is the most important thing. But then going beyond that, New York State is going to have to deal with a crisis that is not just a health crisis, but a crisis across kind of every aspect of the state, because of what's forecast is the state is going to lose at least $10 billion in revenue. And that means that the path that's in front of us is a path where we let Governor Cuomo do what he has done in the past, do what he did after the last financial crisis, and institute devastating cuts. That's the word that he's used. Cuts unlike what anyone in New York has seen before to balance the budget. That means more cuts to healthcare, Medicaid, huge cuts to education, even considering that many students are losing half of a school year. That means more cuts to human services that help and protect and sustain the poorest and the New Yorkers that are living on the front lines of many of these crises. That means affordable housing that is being built, the very small minimal amounts of it, that's going to lose funding. And so the other option is to get through this crisis by asking the people that live within the wealthiest state, one of the wealthiest places on the entire planet, to pay a little bit more. So asking billionaires, there's 112 of them in New York, asking ultra-millionaires, not the person that has a Mercedes that you may see driving around town, but people that make more than $5 million annually. By asking all of those people to pay a percentage or two more, New York State could raise much of the billions of dollars that it's going to need in order to maintain the programs that we know are super important. If we're dealing with any kind of crisis, spending less on public education and investing in our children and spending less on healthcare is never a good idea. And on top of all those things, by pushing to cut Medicaid, the governor has preempted New York to receive almost $7 billion in federal aid. And so on top of the cuts that he wants to push, New York is losing out on more than half of the money that we would need to fill that budget gap.
I think that's a point that's very confusing to people. They're hearing advocates saying that the governor is holding up his hand and saying, I don't want this federal aid because I want to be able to do things my way. And the governor is saying, look, the deal that was cut for New York is no good. It doesn't give us what we need, and the federal government is not giving me the flexibility I need to deal with this crisis. And that's why I think it's hard for our listeners to understand what the issue really is. Can you break it down?
It's really unfortunate that along with all of the attention, and a lot of that attention is earned, that the governor has gotten because of his leadership on many aspects of responding to the coronavirus. With that attention, he, and sometimes misleading people. And I think the provision that the governor in particular has been really upset about is a standard provision. Whenever there's emergencies and the federal government increases the amount of money that it sends to states to help them pay for Medicaid. It's called FMAP, Federal Medicaid Assistance Percentage. Whenever the federal government does that, and they've done it many times in the past, they have a provision called maintenance of effort. And that maintenance of effort is designed to make sure that the money that the federal government is giving to states to help pay for Medicaid actually helps them pay for Medicaid. It says that you can't accept this money and then cut services, right? Because some states, especially some more conservative governors, may take that Medicaid money and want to do something else with it. And so it's a standard provision. And the $6.7 billion in federal aid is healthcare money to fight this healthcare crisis. And the governor is right and wrong, right? We need that money for Medicaid. The governor is planning on cutting Medicaid in the middle of a crisis. It's stupid. And so the governor needs to accept that money. And then on the other hand, and this is why, in addition to accepting that money, we do need to look at raising revenue options. The federal government, the state's going to need more help than that. Coronavirus goes beyond a health crisis. Our economy is going to feel it. All of the crises that existed in New York are now exacerbated by the coronavirus. And so the state is going to need resources and additional funds to handle all of the different impacts of coronavirus. And so it would be nice if the federal government gave some more resources for New York to do that. But let's not pretend like New York's hands are tied. As I said before, there's 112 billionaires here. The governor can maintain Medicaid instead of cutting it. You know, there's $400 million worth of cuts to hospitals in his plan. The plan overall cuts $2.5 billion out of Medicaid. $2.5 billion, that's actually matched by federal money. So the New York healthcare system would actually be losing $5 billion. There are people in New York with almost unimaginable amounts of wealth, and New Yorkers really need to be looking at them to pay more to make sure that the state is whole and that we make it through and we end up on the other side of this crisis in a place where, you know, as many New Yorkers as possible were either unscathed or their lives weren't ruined at the very least, which is what is very possible to happen if the governor goes through with some of these cuts.
Is the tax rate that you're advocating for 1-2% on the ultra rich in New York, is it enough?
The current top tax rate on income in New York is 8.82%. So everyone over $1 million, the income that they make over $1 million, they pay 8.82%. That is right now third. So it's behind California and it's actually behind New Jersey. By moving that top rate up to 11.32%, and that's just for a portion of the incomes, we want to add tiers in because we understand that someone that makes $1 million a year is different than someone makes $1 billion a year or $100 million a year. And so we would institute a new bracket for people that make between 5 and 10 million every year, for people that make between 10 and 100 million every year, and for people that make in excess of 100 million. And so that bracket for people that make in excess of 100 million could go as high, there's kind of two different proposals floating around, as high as 11.32%, I believe it is. And that would raise $4.5 billion, right? So that gets us a long ways to closing the state deficit. If you add that money to the $6.7 billion in federal Medicaid assistance that the state is being offered, that closes the budget gap, right? That 6.7 and that 4.5, it gets us to 11, just over $11 billion. if you do that, you're asking a small number of people in New York who have an incredible amount of money to pay a little bit more. And New Yorkers don't have cuts to their schools or cuts to their healthcare, you know, or cuts to the essential services that they depend on.
This is unlikely to happen in the budget.
As you said, you know, the budget may be passed in the next 24 hours or so. It looks like what the governor is pushing for is a rolling budget process. So basically every couple of weeks or months, they would spend a little bit more money. It's really hard to plan that way. School systems and local governments, it's really hard to plan when you can only think 2 or 3 months ahead. That's how much time they'll have. They'll be like, here's some money that's supposed to last you this long. And they won't know how much money that's going to be until very shortly before the period starts. And so if that process does happen and the governor is constantly doing temporary budgets, then every couple of weeks or months, there'll be a fight over what's included there. And so the fight against cuts, the fight to ask the super wealthy to pay a little bit more so not everyone has to suffer, that's going to be going on throughout the rest of the year.
How can our listeners learn more?
The two places that I would point them to, NewYorkBudgetJustice.com and MakeBillionairesPay.info.
Charles, thank you so much for talking to me. This was illuminating.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Again, that was Charles Kahn of Strong Economy for All. And as of now, it appears that Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers have decided to not raise taxes on the ultra wealthy in this year's budget. In segment two, we talk with Lindsay Koshgarian of the National Priorities Project about the need to shift funds from the Pentagon to deal with the coronavirus crisis.
We're talking with Lindsay Koshgarian, who is the executive director of the National Priorities Project. She had been planning to speak in Albany in the coming weeks with Women Against War, but unfortunately, like many other events, due to the coronavirus, that has been postponed. But Lindsay, why don't you just start off by giving us an introduction to what is the National Priorities Project?
Yes, National Priorities Project was founded in Western Massachusetts just over 35 years ago. A few friends were noticing local programs that were cutting services or shutting down. And when they went to look at why, they discovered that it was the early years of Ronald Reagan and the military budget was going way up and the budget, the federal budget for everything else was going way down. And so ever since then, the National Priorities Project has worked to educate citizens and residents about where our federal dollars go, where your tax dollars go, and what you can do to change those priorities.
Now, of course, right at the moment, we're facing this pandemic and a lot of strain being placed on hospitals and the medical care system, the need for $2 trillion worth of economic bailout, unemployment, you know, rent type issues. So is this a good moment to sort of examine exactly, you know, where are we investing our dollars? Should it be invested so heavily in the military or should we more be, you know, invested in, you know, health services and other safety net programs?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Of course, we know that Congress passed one, as you said, $2 trillion stimulus bill last week, and we're expecting to see another one in the relatively near future. But what we know is that for many decades, the United States has invested heavily in our military capabilities. We have the biggest and by far the best funded military in the world. And we've done that to the detriment of other things. And one of those things has been, of course, our healthcare system, but public health in particular. And for instance, we know that the priorities just from February, right before this kind of all broke into most of our consciousness, the Trump budget that was released on February 10th proposed over the next 5 years, proposed a 32% cut to the CDC budget. So, and we all know how much we're depending on the CDC now. So those priorities are the ones that we've been living with up until now. And of course, the question now is whether, given this new experience, you know, will we stop the path that we've been on for decades, where the Pentagon is prepared at any given time for two major ground wars, while we're not prepared for even one pandemic, even the early weeks of a pandemic? Or will we learn a lesson from this and change our priorities?
We know that a couple of hospital military ships were deployed in New York City and elsewhere. Are there other resources that the military has that could be used at this point to help out the civilian population?
Yes. So we know that the military has sent two of their hospital ships, and that is a desperately needed resource right now. We also know that the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, offered 5 million masks from the Pentagon's own supply toward the pandemic effort. But what we don't know is how many more masks the Pentagon has that they aren't offering toward the pandemic effort. And so there's a big question about who's in charge here, and why is the Secretary of Defense the one who's able to make these decisions, and why is that decision to withhold any of the resources that this country has and that our tax dollars have paid for now in one of the greatest crises that our nation has ever faced? So there are many other examples of that. And there's the fact that in the recent stimulus, the Pentagon got an additional $10 billion to provide services for the coronavirus with no specifications about what those services should be or what the Pentagon should do with that money. And this is an organization that has a pretty bad track record of being able to track where their dollars go.
Now, one of the issues that has come up is the, you know, what we saw after Pearl Harbor was the United States government, you know, redirected a lot of our industrial base to produce things for the war effort. And, you know, here in the Capital District, there's been a push to have General Electric spend more of its production capacity on building ventilators, which is something that they already do. So, I mean, sort of a two-part question. One is, you know, should more of that be occurring? But I also understand from our prior conversation that this type of ordered production is something that the Pentagon actually does on a fairly routine basis?
Yes. So the Defense Production Act is something that a lot of us have just learned about or become acquainted with over the last days in the context of whether or not President Trump was actually going to use the authority to force United States industry to make things like masks and ventilators. But what many of us don't know is that the Defense Production Act is something that the administration already uses multiple times every single day. They're according to the New York Times, a recent investigation, they used it 300,000 times in a year. So this is an authority that they're using left and right when it comes to their plans to produce weapons, to produce missiles, to acquire rare metals for things for military uses. And the question of why they would hold back on using it now is it's just almost unanswerable. It's clearly a political issue, and it's clearly a demonstration of the sway and power that the military industry has over our government.
Now, we already are in a recession, and a lot of the economists are predicting that we very well may hit a depression with unemployment rates possibly as high as 30%. I would assume your group would say this is a really good moment to sort of reflect on how much money we're spending on the military, and is there better ways to spend that $700-800 billion on rebuilding our economy and helping people?
Yes, we're very much asking that question. If we go back to business as usual after this is all over, or whenever it's over, it'll be a real tragedy. We need to invest less in weapons and less in having the biggest military on Earth by many, many times. And we need to invest more in things like public health and our regular healthcare. If we had a functioning healthcare system and if everyone had coverage, a lot of the questions we're seeing now about whether people would have to pay for coronavirus treatment, for example, would not be an issue. So there are so many things that we need to invest in that are really issues of life and death. And this crisis, if anything, is really just bringing that message home.
So we've been talking with Lindsay Kashgarian, who is the Executive Director of the National Priorities Project. Lindsay, if people want more information about the National Priorities Project, how best can they keep in touch with you?
You can find us at www.nationalpriorities.org.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And thank you, Mark, for that segment. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. In our third segment tonight, Watervliet community member and school board member Amanda Cavanaugh talks to HMM correspondent Corinne Carey about the Vliet Never Gives Up t-shirt initiative, which she launched to help support local restaurants and kids in need.
My name is Amanda Cavanaugh. I am a Watervliet community member and school board member. Amanda, when the COVID-19 crisis started to become apparent in upstate New York, what did you decide to do?
I decided to do a fundraiser that would help not just local restaurants in our community, but also the students in our community who are being the most affected. So I decided to start selling t-shirts for $15, and whatever money I profited from the t-shirts, I would use to buy gift cards to local restaurants, and then take those gift cards and give them to the students in our community who are the most economically disadvantaged.
How did you figure out who those students are?
So here in Watervliet, we have a program called Food is Fuel, and every Friday there are about 100 families who receive a backpack full of food. And so those are the families and students that will be receiving the gift cards.
What made you decide to buy gift cards to restaurants as opposed to giving cash or vouchers for grocery stores?
A lot of these children have never actually been out to eat before or been able to order a pizza from a restaurant. So I thought that would certainly help boost their spirits a little bit to have the ability to do that. The other part of it is that a lot of restaurants are suffering. They're personal businesses, they're small businesses, and they're having a really rough time either keeping their doors open if they decide to stay open or worrying about what it's going to look like when they're able to reopen. And these are the businesses that are constantly helping our community. So when we have a senior night at the school, for example, Black Bear, one of the restaurants, caters that, and they certainly give a discount and help out at the school. When we had a pizza clash a few weeks ago to support the junior class, we had several Watervliet restaurants that donated their time and their money to be a part of that. So I felt like it was only fair to do something to give back to the people who are constantly supporting the school.
What do the t-shirts say?
Vliet never gives up.
When you first started this project, what did you expect would happen? What were your goals?
When I first started, I thought to partner with a friend, Meg Franzak, who runs a Facebook page called We Care Vliet, where she often puts out information about what's happening for students and for the community. So my first thought was that I know that I could do this, but having a partner would certainly be helpful. So I got Meg on board. And then I thought we could sell 150 shirts, maybe 200. And now we just put in an order for another 250 shirts, making it in 1 week a total of 750 shirts that we sold. So my expectations have completely been blown out of the water.
That's amazing. So how many gift cards have you been able to distribute to kids?
We have not done that yet. It's been 1 week, so we are collecting all the money. As you can imagine, in this time of social distancing, it's been a little bit difficult to collect money, whether it's cash, check, PayPal, Venmo, and get that all together. But we're hoping that by this Friday, we'll be able to begin our first wave of gift cards.
So how does it work with social distancing? How are you handling it? Picking up the t-shirts from the printer, bringing them back, selling them? How are people getting them?
It's so interesting. So when I picked up the first order of t-shirts, I went to the printing company and I opened my trunk and they loaded them up without any face-to-face contact. And then I came home and sorting them all myself because, you know, you can't have anybody over to help you. So that was a little bit challenging. And then I'm asking people to pick them up at my house. And I set out a little card table in my front yard. And as people text me that they're coming over, I have the t-shirts outside on a table labeled with their name on them so that I don't have to have any contact with them, nor do they have to have any contact with me.
So this isn't the only thing that you do, right? I mean, it sounds like you're going to the door every couple of minutes, but you also have your own full-time job, your responsibilities as a board member. How are you fitting it all in?
Well, you just do. As you mentioned, I'm still working full-time. I have my two children are home, so figuring out homeschooling and dealing with a newly walking one-year-old. But my wife is home and helping me, and Meg, my friend, we're trying to share the responsibilities a little bit. But this is certainly a priority for me right now. You know, I want some happiness for both our local businesses and for our students, because such a difficult time for all of us. And luckily, I'm in a place where I don't have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. Or if I don't want to cook, I can easily, you know, order something to eat out at a local restaurant. A lot of these families who are already not in a great situation financially are even in a worse situation now. So to me, it's certainly important to make sure that we're helping those that need to be helped the most right now.
How have the restaurants reacted?
They are so excited. Three of our local restaurants, actually, On the Hill Cafe, Valenny's, and Arsenal City Tavern, have bought t-shirts for all of their staff members. They're really excited that we're doing this. Arsenal City Tavern, for example, bought some t-shirts for their staff, and they are running a special now where if you order takeout or once their doors open, you wear your t-shirt in there while you go out to dinner, you get 10% off your order. So we're really seeing a lot of support from the restaurants who are trying to help us while still staying above water for themselves. So they're thrilled that this is going on.
And what about the rest of the community? What's been the kind of buzz on the street about this?
I have heard nothing but positive feedback. You know, in a time like this, people are always trying to find ways to help and they want to do something. So that's what it's been. You know, our fire department has donated, our police department has donated. Everyone is really stepping up to do something at this point. And luckily it's this initiative that they're helping with. It's been very positive and heartwarming. You know, there's people who graduated from Water Valete. Yesterday, someone from Syracuse called me and said, I graduated from Water Valete, but I'm a proud Cannoneer. Can I buy two t-shirts and send you money via PayPal? So people everywhere are helping, and we had an anonymous donor for $500. We had another donor for $200. So people have just been sending us money that maybe don't even want a t-shirt or could care less. Instead of giving us $15, they're giving us $20. We've definitely raised probably about $10,000, maybe a little over that even at this point. It's been heartwarming, to say the least.
How can people find out how to help?
Sure. So there is a Facebook page called We Care Valete, V-L-I-E-T. That's a public page that Meg Franzak and I have been posting on quite a bit. So that's the easiest way. It's on Facebook and it's on Twitter. If Facebook and Twitter don't work, people can always send me an email as well. And my email address is acav2716@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Amanda, thank you so much for talking to me about this.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. And I appreciate all the support that we've gotten in the community. It's a great positivity thing to look at during a stressful time.
It sure is. Thanks.
And you just heard HMM's Corinne Carey with Amanda Kavanaugh about the Vliet Never Gives Up t-shirt initiative. On our next segment, it's ColorWorks Radio. Justin Baker talks with Darian Longmire of Brooklyn about his experience as an artist during COVID-19 and how it's affecting his life right now.
Hey, this is ColorWorks Radio, and I'm your host, Justin Baker. With me this week is Darian Longmire, an artist from Brooklyn, New York. Darian opens up about his experience as an artist during COVID-19 and how it's affecting his life right now. So listen up.
Yeah, so I've been in Brooklyn for about 2 years, and the way I was kind of making it work initially was by way of the freelance economy and the gig-based economy. Yeah. I was like kind of a freelance barista, and I was working on TaskRabbit, and then I was doing like just like weird art gigs here and there. I was working for like art studio packing boxes. And so then I figured out how to like sort of raise part of my rent as partly doing freelance and another part just by doing art pop-ups. So as a artist, I started off like as a printmaker. Yeah. I was really interested in repeatable images, and I have, you know, naturally I'm from the Midwest as well. I'm from Chicago, even though I'm in Brooklyn currently. And so I started off as a printmaker, and I have a ton of work on paper. And so that work became sort of like the way for me to sell things on the side as an artist, as I've been living in Brooklyn. But, you know, early March, like I just finished up an art pop-up at the end of February, and it was pretty successful. And in the 2 years of being in Brooklyn, I felt like I've had a lot of momentum slowly like building up. But then it's like COVID hit in sort of like the early March, and I had like another pop-up I was planning, and now it got canceled. And then I had like some exhibition opportunities in upstate New York, and those also got canceled. So then it was like, you know, we were just like in the middle of, and this was before there was conversation about government assistance or any sort of like idea that freelancers would even be eligible for unemployment. And so it was crazy going through it all, because like it just happened in New York City so quick.
Basically. Yeah. Was that the feeling that it happened quick?
Yeah, it was like instantaneous, because I actually had, because, you know, like you just go, you jump from gig to gig in New York City, or at least I've been doing that, because it frees my schedule up a little bit more to be in the studio. Sure. And I think that when I first moved to this Brooklyn and I was living in the city, I was fresh out of grad school as an artist, and I was just trying to acclimate to Brooklyn. And then I found a flow of trying to make work while working full time, but that became so difficult. And so I think the freelance economy and the gig economy for a lot of people was like key, you know, kind of our key to being artists in New York, not having to work full time or being able to take like 1 week off, 1 week on. And that's kind of what I was doing. But then, yeah, it's like as soon as COVID started happening, like I had two interviews lined up, and it was just like everything vanished. And it was like a matter of maybe 3 to 4 days. And so then it was just kind of like, I just kind of panicked, and I was like, oh, I don't have rent for April now.
Okay. Yeah.
It's
nerve-wracking.
Right.
Now, I mean, like, you're in Bushwick, which is kind of like, I know there's a lot of artists who live there and a lot of small galleries. And I mean, has the community for that, like, just kind of vanished? Or
For Bushwick, I mean, everything's closed, so we all really can't do anything. I mean, there's no nightlife here currently, so there's not even really like an energy. But I think people are still trying to figure out how to sustain an art practice. So like a lot of people like me, I figured out I've been making mixed media work and paintings by hand, because that's the most immediate way of working in New York City, because I don't have access to, you know, fancy facilities. I just have my studio. Yeah. So making works by hand is sort of just like makes the transition a little bit easier. I don't know where I was going with that.
That makes sense. I mean, to like return to like the simplest kind of way of making work for you. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If anything, the quarantine is also like, I think it is maybe cut some of opportunities like externally in terms of like the art, you know, art mm-hmm. opportunities. But I feel like it's been a free time to kind of take a personal residency and start some new paintings and some new things. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of artists are kind of maybe just taking it that way. And I think where I was going before is I was making work and I figured out how to sort of like digitize the mixed media work and paintings I was doing. And I was able to make digital prints and kind of like have that be something I sold through Instagram. So I think a lot of artists we immediately sort of turned to our digital or social media presence. And we just started selling work that way. Or at least I did, because I was already used to trying to peddle artwork a little bit. I've seen a lot of my other fellow artists doing that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, to go back to your art practice and maybe like a little bit about you. You're from Chicago, like from the Midwest.
Yeah.
And then you came to New York via SUNY Albany, right? I mean, is that what brought you here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. So yeah, I was in Chicago and like, you know, I sort of grew up as like a typical inner city kid on the west side of Chicago. And I hung out there and I was really into the internet and subculture, because I'm like a millennial, I'm 29. So very much was into web design, graphic design, and things that were nerdy, things that were like subcultural or underground. And then, you know, growing up in Chicago, that's how I sort of stumbled into college and went away. And I was like, you discover in college, you're going to be an artist, or at least I did by mistake, trying to be a graphic designer at first. Uh-huh. And then I started really being serious about being an artist right at the end of college. So I was still back in Chicago, just living at home and getting ready for what was going to be grad school. So I was trying to make a lot of work in Chicago. And, you know, being a kid who comes from like techno culture, I would say, and the underground, like Afrofuturism was something I really started. It was something that was pointed out to me in my work actually in Chicago as I was making a lot of prints, because I had a fellowship. This was before I even got to New York or grad school. And so once it was pointed out to me, I just sort of noticed all the coincidences in my life and how they kind of linked up with my studio practice and creating this like speculative alternative way of thinking about identity. And in my work, I kind of talk about this dichotomy of blackness or this construct. And I think that I'm trying to kind of, you know, pull it apart or problematize it, because I think it's a funny category. It's a non-existent category. Mm-hmm. That's something that's become really insistent in my work, is there's so much invisible matter and so much invisible, so many invisible particular experiences to the Black experience. And I'm trying to like kind of paint about that or make digital works or sound. I've also been doing like sound compositions.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been trying everything. But
can we go back to one thing you said a minute ago? I found kind of interesting. You say you fell into being an artist, or you fell backwards into. I forget which way you said it, but could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I was in college and I was just sort of like trying to be a graphic designer, and I was didn't really have a major, and I was just sort of like someone, you know, a kid who was coming out of high school making digital art and really interested in the subculture and counterculture, I should say, rather, at that time, I guess. And, you know, music and just art. And so, yeah, those things influenced the work. And, you know, as I was in college, I was trying to be a graphic designer because I thought that was, like, going to make money. But then the program was too competitive. So then I just was, like, kind of floating around, and I started taking art classes.
As always, thanks for listening. Please go to collarworks.org and check out Connect. Paired selections from the Flat Files, curated by Deborah Zlotsky, an online exhibit. Just like everybody else. Also, coming up soon, Collarworks TV, virtual studio tours of featured artists.
And HMM is so happy to have Collarworks back on the air, bringing us everything art and culture in New York State. You just heard Collarworks radio host Justin Baker with Darian Longmire, who's a Brooklyn-based artist, and you can hear part two of their interview next week. To close out our show tonight, Michelle Masurjan speaks with Ty Cobb, who is the Director of Strategic Initiatives and Research with Human Rights Campaign, about the impact of COVID-19 on the LGBTQ community.
Hello all, this is Michelle Masurjan for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. My guest today is Ty Cobb, Director of Strategic Initiatives and Research for Human Rights Campaign, which advocates for the LGBTQ community. Welcome, Mr. Cobb.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So a few weeks ago, the Human Rights Campaign Foundation published a report regarding the impact of coronavirus on the LGBTQ community. And according to the report, there are nearly 14 million LGBTQ adults and 2 million LGBTQ youth in the United States. Let's talk about some of the key issues noted in the report. And one of them was it noted that the LGBTQ community works in highly affected industries. What are those and what is the impact of this pandemic on the LGBTQ community?
Thanks for that question. I think that as the pandemic gained more and more attention here in the U.S., we wanted to look much more deeply into the unique way LGBTQ folks are being affected by the pandemic. And in doing so, we looked at survey data that's out there to understand that the top five industries that LGBTQ people are employed in are in dining and restaurants. They are in hospitals, in K through 12 education. They're in higher academia, higher ed environments, as well as serving in retail. And what we saw in looking that we're in these areas, over 40% of the community actually is employed in these areas. And these are some of the most impacted areas when it comes to the pandemic. And in each of these areas, the community is overrepresented in comparison to our non-LGBTQ counterparts. And so just taking the restaurant and dining industry into account, I think we've all seen the decrease in folks going out because of the quarantines to restaurants. Restaurants really struggling to survive, as well as their wait staff and the servers and the cooks and everybody that makes our restaurants and dining scenes work. In addition, if you look into the education environment, teachers are having to quickly adapt to a virtual work environment or an environment where teaching is on hold for the near term. In trying to understand and cope with what does that mean as educators for fulfilling their mission, or there's no doubt that those who are employed in hospitals are right now on the front line of serving the American people, or when you look at retail, there aren't many people going out in retail environments right now, and their jobs are also on the line. And so when you look across kind of where the community is in industries in the United States, we're heavily impacted by the epidemic.
From that report, were there anything in there that surprised you?
Well, I mean, I think that just recognizing how severely the community may be economically impacted, given the shifts in both restaurants and also in retail was surprising. Also knowing kind of how engaged the community is within hospitals and how much they're on the front lines was really surprising and important to recognize. And I think also, as we looked through the data about how the pandemic affects LGBTQ people, We also saw, we're also uniquely vulnerable because if you look at wealth, we are 1 in 5 LGBTQ folks live below the poverty line. If you look at having access to insurance, a large percentage of LGBTQ folks still do not have access to insurance. 1 in 5 have not gone to get a medical procedure in recent years because they could not afford it. 29% of LGBTQ people do not have access to paid leave for a medical issue that may come up and they need to continue to be paid. In addition, when you look at issues around asthma, smoking, diabetes, the community is overrepresented in the populations that might be most impacted by the pandemic.
So given that, so their income is being impacted, and let's say I'm a transgender person and I need to get my hormone medication, or I need my bandages, or I have a surgery scheduled. How is this impacting them now? I might not have insurance. I might have inadequate insurance. What's the impact?
Well, I mean, I think that the entire medical environment or our healthcare environment has been shifted. Hospitals and doctors are having to triage the most severe of cases that come before them. That means that some in the trans community are finding out that perhaps gender affirmation surgeries that were scheduled have been postponed. Some are concerned about putting themselves in the environment to go pick up hormones from a pharmacy, or are having a hard time getting in touch with their doctor right now because doctors are being overwhelmed with people reaching out to be tested for COVID or understanding what to do once they've tested positive. And so with the healthcare system so inundated with dealing with issues around the pandemic, trans folks do find themselves in a situation that has really evolved over the last several weeks in a different direction.
So what direction do you see that going? I mean, are there groups that are helping them pay for their medication? Or let's say if you need that hormone therapy, I know there's a lot of non-for-profit groups that do support these folks. I mean, what's the impact even on the non-for-profit groups, which I understand a lot of their services are having group support, and now you have the social isolation, you know, social distancing. What's happening to them?
Well, I think that's a great question. Direct service providers across the country that work in the nonprofit world are really having to rethink their model. Mm-hmm. And how do they get folks virtually in a safe environment? How do they get to the people in the community who may be used to accessing their services by walking through a door when the door is now shut? Mm-hmm. And I can't say everybody's figured out how to do it. I think we're all learning day to day about better ways to serve the community in this new environment, but I think we all have a lot of learning still to do.
Have you heard of anything innovative in that area in trying, I mean, are they using Zoom or things like that?
Right. Well, I can see at HRC, we really are taking advantage of the opportunity to have town halls with our members that are virtual to talk about the pandemic and what it means about the community. With our most recent board meeting, we went to a virtual environment to make sure that everybody stayed safe, but make sure we also pass a budget to be able to support this work in the next fiscal year. Our fiscal starts this week. And so we're really having to adapt. We're also trying to put out as many resources as we can to direct folks who may be facing unemployment in this environment to get them to the public assistance they may need. And we all have to adapt in making sure we're getting out the information we need to get out to people in ways that they can consume it.
So one of the things noted in the report was the issue of homeless youth, LGBTQ homeless youth, and elderly LGBTQ. And I didn't realize there was such a large community, you know, those two groups. You want to kind of talk about them?
Absolutely. When you look at homeless youth across the U.S., somewhere up to 40% may identify as LGBTQ, which is an enormous population. And I think we've got to continue to make sure that as we're thinking through the pandemic, we're thinking about how our nation's homeless are being served in during the epidemic. We also, when it comes to LGBTQ seniors, we have some unique situations where an LGBTQ senior is more likely to be living on their own without family support around them of any type. In a moment where we're being, where seniors are more likely to have the most severe consequences from the virus, we're asking people to stay inside, and that means we're asking LGBTQ seniors to stay inside in total isolation without a safety net around them, and often a family or a supportive environment or someone within their home.
I'm going to have to wrap it up here. Are there any closing thoughts, and where can folks get additional information about the Human Rights Campaign and the work it does and the, some of the resources that you mentioned?
Absolutely. Well, I think as in all emergencies, the most vulnerable in any country are on the margins and are at most risk. And the LGBT community in this situation is one of those communities. And so as people are thinking through responses to the pandemic, to make sure you're thinking through, what does this mean for LGBTQ youth who may be sent home from school to an unsupportive environment? What does this mean for the LGBTQ senior who may not have a social net around them to support them through isolation? And so making sure that as people are thinking about the response to the pandemic, that LGBTQ people are front of mind. And for folks who want to get more familiar with the resources that HRC is putting out, you can go to www.hrc.org. And we have a series of resources, whether you're a parent who has kids at home and want lesson plans. We put out lesson plans every Wednesday for our Welcoming Schools Wednesdays, or whether you are wanting to see the most recent research brief we put out about the impact of the pandemic on the community, you can find them there at www.hrc.org.
Thank you very much, Ty. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
And you just heard Ty Cobb, Director of Strategic Initiatives and Research, speaking with HMM correspondent Michelle Masurjan. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith, and thank you to all the wonderful producers, script writers, headline writers, and support people out there working to make the show continue. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose online on our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, you can do so remotely. Just send us an email to info@mediasanctuary.org, or just drop in our weekly virtual meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. And you can get the link to that through by sending us a message at info@mediasanctuary.org. You can also get in touch with us on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary and on Instagram and Twitter @mediasanctuary. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.